It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 680. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for show topics at miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message on Skype. The name is Mike Tech Show, all one word. If you were trying to leave a message on the old Skype number, that's no longer available. So you have to use Skype and go right to Mike Tech Show. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Mike Tech Show, and also facebook.com/Mike Tech Show. This show is brought to you by Instant House Call. Remotely support your customers unattended and on demand through firewalls. Try it free by clicking the link on my website at miketechshow.com. Use the promo code Mike Tech Show for your free 15-day trial, and you can also go directly to instanthousecall.com. Jam-packed show. I have stories from the trenches, a few projects, and some things coming up the last few weeks. We're going to talk about the Windows 7, an update problem, also end of life for Windows 7, and disabling offline files. So a few Windows 7 stories. The email migration from hell, part two, some common network issues, and a great stack of email. So let's start it off with the email migration that I talked about a few shows ago. Part two, when I exported everything from Outlook 2016, and this was an Exchange-hosted server, domain controller, I went right to the top of the profile, right to the top of the account, did an export of everything to a PST file. Well, I get a call a couple weeks ago, and this is a month after the migration. Everybody started realizing any email older than a year was not there. And I was like, I exported everything. How can this be? In Outlook, in the newer versions, I think it started with 2013 and definitely 2016. One of the things you have to worry about on the profile, when you're in cached mode, there's a little lever that goes all mail or just the past year, and it defaults to the past year. I made sure, or at least I thought I did, that everything was all mail. And I don't know why we exported for two users where I made no changes seemed to get all of their email. Actually, three users got all of their mail. But the other eight users were missing everything older than a year. So I needed some help with this because now I don't want to really start everything again on Exchange because, you know, I talked about having the auto discover and all the changes that we had to make, but I had to fire up all of the services for Exchange. And once I got all the services up, Exchange was not working. I had to call Winston Wolf again real quick. And he said, Mike, I think we need to reset IIS. So I'm going to have links for all of this. So once we reset IIS, I was able to get in to the Exchange PowerShell. And I have a great link on exporting mailboxes. And if you are Exchange Server 2010, Service Pack 1 or greater, and we checked, I was Service Pack 3, then you can use this export command. And it's complicated, and I was able to put everything in there with the username and where I wanted the PST, and it took a long time. I tried to do too many at once, and I noticed I was getting failures on a bunch of the exports. So I did one export at a time, and boy, I did get everything because all of those files were significantly bigger than the ones I was dealing with the night of the migration. So clearly there was a lot of email missing. And I'm talking about this because I wanted to if I ever run across a server where it's they host their own email, this is the only way I am going to export the mail. Exported it all, called the client the next day and said, I need to come over and copy all those files onto one of my external drives because I have a much faster upload. And I made sure this was a Friday that I was doing this, where I went over and copied everything. This was a Thursday. You know what? This was a Thursday night. This might have been one of the reasons I canceled a show a few weeks ago. I got everything exported successfully. I was up pretty late. And then Friday, I went over, I grabbed all of the files, and now I FTP'd them back up to Sherweb because there's like an FTP area that you can then marry those files back to the account, and they take care of it at the back end. One of the things I had to check, I wanted to make sure there were no duplicate emails. And by default, even though I had the first year and they already had it, it would not load duplicates. So they took and exported, well, actually imported all those PSTs to the right accounts. For the weekend, I asked them to just leave all the systems on and Outlook running, making sure that the bar was set for each one for all mail, and then just let it flow. Monday, no calls at all. I call to my person that I work with there, the liaison for the business, and she said, Mike, everybody's happy. All the email is there. It's just been so long since I dealt with a physical exchange server on site. Hosting exchange. It's been years since I ran into that. And this slipped by me. And I think one of the reasons is if we were Outlook 2010, there would have been no problem because you don't have to deal with this year and all mail. I think when I was exporting, those clients must have been set for only a year. But why didn't they notice that before that there were missing mail? I don't know. The end of the story, they now have all their mail for all the years and all the history. And the client is happy. Something I've ran into over the last couple weeks, and you might run into this with clients, businesses, where maybe a department buys a router and they just plug it in because they think they're doing themselves a favor by creating a Wi-Fi hotspot for themselves in that area. Well, you've just created a separate network. So this is a business client, but for his house, he added another device to extend Wi-Fi, but it wasn't extending Wi-Fi. He really put a router in place, which automatically creates a separate network. And it was funny when I was remoting in, he says, Mike, this laptop will not print. And then I started talking, well, what did you do? What? And he said he added this device, and he says it's working great for the internet, but I can't see the printer. And I went, and I said, give me a machine that is working to the printer. And I showed him the IP address, of the printer. I said, now let's go back to the machine that's not. And I showed him that IP address. Now, one was a 192.168. The other one was a 10.0. I said, there's no way they're going to print. I said, we now have to convert this device to be an access point, not a router. And this happens so many times when I'm brought into a networking problem, it's because they needed better Wi-Fi and they bought a router. Someone sold them a router, whether it was Best Buy or wherever they were. They don't understand. It takes us to be able to go in and solve the problem, but it's something to look for if you start getting crazy networking problems. Take a look at the IP addresses of all the devices involved and making sure that they're all on the same subnet. So this router had an option to change from a router to an access point. It was just one button and it just took care of everything. And that's why I like the ASUS routers. If you can't do that, then you got to dumb down the router to be an access point. And you do that by turning off DHCP, giving it a static IP address on the network, and having no WAN connection, just a LAN. And then you now have an access point. A link in the show notes for Windows 7 ends support 1 year from now. So January of 2020, there will no longer be updates. So for Windows 7, this is now the year where you should take any client, anybody you run into that has Windows 7, and you upsell Windows 10. I want to do a clean install of Windows 10. But what I recommend, if they do not have a solid state drive already, say, let's upgrade you to a solid state drive and then do Windows 10 from scratch. If you have a legitimate Windows 7 key on the system, that will still upgrade for free. That's right. I don't care what you read. I don't care what you say. I do this every day on Dell, especially Dell Optiplexes that have a Windows 7 key. You just type that key in after you do Windows 10 from scratch. It will activate, even though they say it won't. Doing an upgrade like that, it's now easy to use like FABS Auto Backup to take their external drive, mount it into a SATA to USB cable or device, and now you could do a transfer of the data once you get Windows 10 installed. It's a piece of cake. You should be making hand over fist money on this. I have clients, I've already started positioning and scheduling the Windows 7 migration to Windows 10, and especially anybody that has anything to do with compliance. If they take credit cards, it's PCI compliance. If it's any kind of a doctor's office, HIPAA compliant. If it's financial, then it's FINRA. They are not compliant after January 2020 if they're still running Windows 7. This is a great opportunity to leverage this to protect your client and make money if you haven't been doing that. So I know I'm going to be very busy this year. A lot of my clients have already upgraded to Windows 10, but I still have some of those holdouts with Windows 7, and I am contacting them, and we're going to start slowly scheduling them throughout the year. Windows 7 had an ugly update a couple weeks ago from Patch Tuesday, and they broke sharing on Windows 7 machines. They messed with the networking incorrectly. And the link that I will have is for KB4480970. I had three clients that it broke their ability to be able to scan back to their scanner, or the scanner to be able to see the share back on their desktop. I had to uninstall that update and then go in and hide it so it wouldn't come down again. And lo and behold, it worked. And I have to thank one of my BNI members, Dennis, who works for Fraser. They do multifunction machines and printers. Their techs found it first with one of my clients, where that one of their devices, one of their Sharp multifunction devices. And it was my client that told me, and I was like, great. So I reached out to Dennis and I said, Dennis, you got to give me what the tech did. And he did. He found out and he sent me everything. So because I had three other clients that were having this problem, and then I was able to solve them. So that was very, very helpful. I have some great links. I think since then, Microsoft has pushed an additional update. But if you're running into a strange problem, all of a sudden, the multifunction device or printer can no longer see the network share on that system, and it's Windows 7, you got this particular KB update that you got to get rid of. Now, I was speaking with Windows 7. A client calls me and says, Mike, I'm mapped to, it's just two systems on a little peered network, two attorneys. Well, I should say the admin assistant, the paralegal, and the attorney. The attorney maps to the paralegal system and saves files and, you know, prints things, and that's where all their files are. All of a sudden, she starts seeing files she puts there. She can't see them. They're not there. I was like, that's impossible. I tested this. The files she sees is not the same when I'm on the system. So I have both systems up with Instant House Call. I go to the exact share. I browse via the network and the sharing. And let's say there's a list of 10 PDFs in this one directory. The one person who's mapped and exactly there and has the permissions only sees three. This was baffling. This took me researching a couple days this week at night, trying to figure this out. And I figured it out. Matter of fact, Tuesday night, I figured it out. So the first thing was, everybody, when you're reading the forums, it says, disable the offline folders. I was like, that's it. And she had offline folders on. Disabled offline folders. And then there was another problem. As I did that, I got locked out and I couldn't remote back into Instant House Call. So they had to somehow, me doing that kind of locked up the system. They had to reboot it and said, Mike, I still can't see the files. I was like, oh, what's going on? So I'm reading, I'm trying everything until finally, and there's one little article. They said, remove the permissions from the shared directory and reapply it. And I was like, okay, I have the users who has the right name and password. I was like, okay, let me do that. I removed it, reapplied it. I go back to the other system that couldn't see them. It was instantaneous. They all appeared. It was there. So resetting the permissions fixed the problem. If you run into some obscure thing like that, it does, and it's only one share or two shares, it doesn't hurt to just reapply the permissions from the host machine and then go try from the client machines and see if you can attach. That just boggled the mind. It made no sense. Let's get to emails. And this is from Philip. And he said he tried to leave a voicemail. And that's why in the beginning of the show, I wanted to say, I no longer have that number for Skype. And he's just caught up on the last two shows and he dictated this email. So forgive me as I'm reading it, it was dictated. So he warns me up front. Just a quick note about a recent experience I had a few months ago with regard to Hulu and Amazon. And this is for Hulu and Amazon people getting caught in those subscription services. I canceled an internet service a while ago. And since I canceled that service, I had my credit card expire and the number changed. The expiration date changed. I basically got a new credit card as well. A year after I canceled that service, I got a charge on my American Express with this new card number for the amount, for $335. I called up American Express. I verified that I was the legitimate cardholder and from this company. And this internet company that he called, and he had canceled the service. Here's what the bottom line is. It's kind of interesting, but you got to be aware of this. American Express told him, and he says, I suspect that Visa and MasterCard may do this also, but I do not know for sure, that automatically reoccurring payments, when they send out a new credit card, they will honor those payments when they come in. Really? I mean, I've had a card change and it's been denied. And then I get an email saying, hey, your card's been rejected. You got to go in and update it. I got to admit, I've never had this happen with American Express. I told American Express I was not happy about this. And I asked them to cancel all reoccurring payments and do it immediately. They were hesitant to do this and told me that it's not a wise idea because then I'm going to have to reauthorize all the automatic payments I had. I told them that's exactly what I wanted, and I insisted that they do it now. I also insisted that they make a note on my account that when I receive a new credit card number, all reoccurring payments are canceled and I must reauthorize. They said, okay, no problem. We'll do it right away. That's a big mental relief for me to know that everything can start from zero whenever I call and ask for a new credit card. That's very interesting because I bet you there's a lot of people listening that are on both sides of the fence there. And I'm sort of in the middle because, boy, I hate when I get a new credit card because I'm told, look, this other one's going to expire. And I got like a few days to quickly, okay, where am I using this card? Now, I kind of know and I have a list secured that I can go in, but it's a pain. You know, I got to go in, especially if it's like for easy pay, you know, for refilling the card, you know, something like that. I don't want to be stuck, you know, going illegally through a toll because
they didn't fill the card for Easy Pay, you know, something like that. With the big sellers that I buy from online, that's easy. I know them. I know to go in there and update. But it's an interesting point, and I'm glad you shared that, because it makes you think now when you get a new credit card, or if you see that rogue charge that you thought, wait a second, I canceled this, or my card changed, there's no way that should have worked. Well, now you got a reason to call the bank to make sure, and that it is possible that they would honor an old card payment because it was reoccurring. This is Jeremy. Question: switching from MacBook to PC. Mike, first of all, thank you for all you do for us in the tech community. I know this sounds so simple, but I'm thinking of switching from my old MacBook Pro to a true Windows PC. That said, I was thinking about the Surface Pro and getting the dock to go along with it. I thought I heard on one of your podcasts that either you or your son has the Microsoft Surface, actually I do, and wanted to get your opinion of it. It would be used as my daily driver that I would be taking with me everywhere. Other than the lack of ports without the dock, are there any deal breakers of using the Surface Pro as my primary device? No, I like my Surface Pro, and I like traveling with it because it's so thin, so small, and has everything that I need to be able to accomplish it except the ports. And that's one of the things where I have a device that does Ethernet and USB 3, because you only get one USB 3 port, and I'm holding this Inatec device up in the chat so everybody can see it, and there's an Ethernet port, and then there's USB ports, so it gives me a lot of the ports that I want, but sometimes performance drags. And it's not the greatest thing in the world all the time. It depends on what you're doing and the load that you're going to put on those USB ports. So from that perspective, if you don't have a lot of things to connect, and I strongly recommend a Bluetooth mouse. So this way you don't have to waste one of those USB ports for your mouse. If you can live with one USB port, thumbs up. It's a great device. I like it, but make sure you get a big enough hard drive. My minimum on a Surface Pro is it's got to be at least a Core i5, and it's got to have 8 gig of RAM and 256 gig SSD inside. If you can go 512, if you can go Core i7, if you can go 16 gigs of RAM, that becomes very, very expensive. But 8 gig, to me, 8 gig is the minimum amount of RAM you can have today for Windows 10. I will not allow anything below that. And then I want an SSD and nothing smaller than 256. And with the prices, the way they're coming down, 512 is great. But that's if you're building your own. The Surface Pro, you're stuck at Microsoft's prices. But I definitely will give it a thumbs up. My main uses would be setting up network devices using PuTTY, web browsing, office applications, Windows Remote Desktop, my RMM, Pulseway, etc. I like the idea of being able to take notes using the pen, but I'm not sure how much I would really use it day to day. I had great intentions, but don't use the pen. I know you have a lot going on and can't spend time to address all these questions in detail, but if you get a minute, maybe you can give me a quick reply to let me know if it's worth breaking out the money to buy one. Jeremy, I hope this podcast reaches you in time, because you sent this. Actually, it's only about a week old or so. So this is good timing. So here's the thing. If you're going to do networking, you're going to need a dedicated USB to Ethernet adapter. I recommend the Microsoft one. That will help you when you're on site if you got to configure something on Ethernet. You don't want to share that with anything else. So I carry one of those adapters with me, but I'll tell you, that's not my work laptop when I'm out in the field. I got a great older Lenovo refurb, put extra RAM in it, put an SSD, got Windows 10. It's got USB ports. It's got a Ethernet built in. And if something happens to it, I don't care.
I only spent a couple hundred bucks for it. I like having a couple throwaway laptops, I'll say disposable almost, that I can take with me out in the field when I'm working, because anything can happen. They can drop, they can break, they can. I don't take my Surface Pro to a client. So that's why I wanted to be clear. I take that for traveling for me because it's so light and compact and easy for me to travel. As a matter of fact, I travel with that and my iPad Pro. As a matter of fact, then I used the Duet app and a cable, and it's like having two monitors when I'm in a hotel room. It's beautiful. That's how I use it. And hopefully this advice helps you and guides you for what you want to do. But if you're out in the field a lot doing work, get an inexpensive laptop that you're not going to lose sleep over if something happens to it. Preventing Windows updates, from Jonathan. Another way I have found to stop Windows 10 updates, even on the home version, is to set all networking connections as metered. I have seen a few cases where it will still install updates, yes, but it's usually when I restart the computer manually. At least it helps a lot. This method may not work if the computer is going to be connected to new Wi-Fi networks, because I don't know a way to set new Wi-Fi networks as metered yet. This also keeps Windows Defender from updating without manual intervention. I'm looking for a computer for my mom. I think one of your refurbished ones may work great. She does a lot of web browsing and not much else. I'm thinking 12 gig of RAM. That's an odd number, 12. Why 12? You know, I could see 8 or 16. For lots and lots of Firefox, Windows, and an i3 CPU, and a smaller than normal SSD. No. What if she starts putting pictures on it? Or even a hard drive is perfectly fine. That 500 gig SSD you mentioned on the last Tech Vets would work. I plan to put Linux, probably Linux Mint, on it. So if it keeps the price down, I don't need Windows, and I'm trying to keep my price low. What options do you have? You know, there's some really great Dell older Vostros that you add a little RAM, put an SSD in there. It's a Core i3. As a matter of fact, I still have one refurb like that, that you can get at a really good price. Even some of the Optiplexes, you know, Trollwoot, WOOT.com. They're owned by Amazon, but sometimes you got some great buys there. Take a look at that, and you get some really good prices. Linux Mint for your mom. Very, very interesting, but I have a better idea. And Tim just took the words right out of my mouth. A Chromebook. She is the perfect candidate for a Chromebook. Clean, simple, just use Chrome, get her a Gmail account for her email, have all of the extensions for whatever she wants to watch. It's perfect. She is the perfect demographic for a Chromebook. And I really recommend that out of all the systems. And it's so inexpensive and affordable. Under 200, and she's going to be very happy. Let me know how you make out, Jonathan. I don't recommend Linux. There's so many things that can go wrong for her with that. I mean, and I like Linux, but I think a Chromebook's easier to manage for your mom, at least from a tech support standpoint for you. This is Mark. I was catching up on my podcast and heard you with the issue of the iPhone transfers of music. I use iMazing for my backups of my iPhones, and you can restore your music to a new iOS device pretty easily. And he has the link here. It's great software with a free trial. I always buy it because it works so well. Mac and PC compatible. Hope you have a great 2019. Having spent a fair amount of time in ERs the last 2 years, I sympathize with your issue. Good luck. Thank you. And this is Mark. I appreciate that. And I will absolutely check out that program you recommended. Final email for the night. This is a great email. Give a listen to this. He's starting on his own. Mike, I have a really quick question. I've been working for other companies as a tech for over 20 years. There are some things that I
would like to cross off my bucket list. If you will, and one is owning my own IT business. However, would it even make sense for someone at my age, 45? I'm trying to think real quick. 45? How about being 48? That's when I went on my own. Because I'm, am I 59 now? I'm 59. Hold on. I was 49. So you're worried at 45? I started my own business at 49. Now to continue. To do this when I have a great job and a good salary, and he's making good money. I spoke with a friend that went out on his own a while back, and although he said that he has some months where he has made, you know, 20 grand in revenue, the next month has almost zero. This is making me rethink the whole idea. Any thoughts for someone that is on the fence about this? Thank you for all you do for the community. You rock. Signed, Jeremy. Jeremy, I have great advice because it's how I started while I was in the corporate world. I slowly took on clients that knew I was not available during the day. I could only help them on evenings and weekends. Now, it may take a lot of work to do that. It's okay. 45, you're young. Go try to get after-hour business. See how it goes. Start building up some steady clients and some steady work. Maybe it's just doing updates. It's monitoring backups. Let me tell you, monitoring and looking after backups, that is an evening job. Matter of fact, that's when they want you to do their updates of their systems. Get instant house call and put that on systems and start locking them into contracts for you to continue to do updates and monitor their systems. Here's one of the things you want to do. It sounds like your friend was break fix. And when I started my business, I was break fix, meaning I waited for the business to come to me. Maybe I was out there trying to hustle and get some work. But for the most part, I was at the mercy of my clients calling me. That model did not work for me. I needed clients on a regular retainer contract that paid monthly. It spread their IT costs out evenly. It then gave them priority in my queue when they call the retainer clients. And we're now proactive. We're not reactive. So that's how you sell it. And if you go back to tech-vets.com and listen to a lot of the older shows that Carrie Holzman and I did, you will learn a lot about starting your own IT business. And even going back to a lot of the older Mike Tech shows, I interweave this within a lot of the shows. But having contracts was the only way I could survive, or I would have been back in the corporate world working. And then, as I'm found later on, sometimes you lose clients. They get bought by another company that has a bigger IT department, or they retire, or they go out of business, or there's so many things. You got to be constantly, constantly looking for additional work and business. You cannot sit back. Even if things are going well and you're happy, you got to be always prepared. Was it always ABC, always be closing? You got to be that way. You got to always be looking for business. And that I learned the hard way. Take it from me. You're still young in trying to start your own business. Do not be afraid. But keep your day job because of your benefits and because of all the perks from having that. And see if you can. Do you have the time and the bandwidth at night and weekends? Put your toe in the water for consulting and see how that is. How much vacation do you get? I'll never forget using a week's vacation for a project for a client that it was, if I wasn't available during the day, during that week of the migration for the server, they were not going to use me. And they knew up front, I said, I have a day job. I said, I'll take vacation that week. And they said, done. And that was great. And I merged two law firms where it was a week off and I was able to get everything done and get everything merged. So get creative. And try to do that. I don't know. Are you able to take, after things get going and you're really close, can you take a leave of absence? I don't know. I don't know how flexible, you know, your current boss is and where you're working. But there's ways you can do this and start to build up some work. And you may decide, you know what?
You may have enough work on the side that it's better to be on the side, and you may never leave your day job and just have this extra income coming in. I know I thought of that. That's another possibility. So now you've got this extra disposable income to feed your tech habit or maybe take nicer vacations or do something. I don't know. But that's another option and another path. So I hope I gave you some good ideas, Jeremy, and helped you out. That is it for tonight's show. The best way you can support the show is to use the Amazon link in our show notes at miketechshow.com. That link will support Carrie Holzman and myself when you purchase from Amazon. You got to click on the link, then add the items to your cart and check out during that session, and we will get credit where a small commission comes back to us. Your price stays the same. That helps support Tech Vets, the Mike Tech Show, Carrie Holzman, and myself. Fabs Auto Backup, you heard me mention it. What a great piece of software, as you now got to upgrade everybody who's Windows 7 and you got to get them to Windows 10. That's the perfect software. Fabs Auto Backup 7 Pro, got to have it. And for remote support, there's nothing better than Instant House Call. I love it. I use it every day. My techs use it every day. I'm going to be using it again tonight after I'm done with the show here for some work that I got to finish up remotely. That's it. Be back next Thursday. Same time, same channel. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.